Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
And now, from beyond our dimension, this is the Jeff Mara Podcast. Here's Jeff.
My guest is Randall Carlson, master builder and renegade scholar who explored the interface between ancient mysteries and modern science for over 4.5 decades. He's been an active Freemason for 45 years and has led over 50 tours exploring sites of antiquity and geological catastrophism. Today we're going to discuss his research into earth changes, catastrophic events, and more. Randall, thank you for joining me and welcome.
Well, my pleasure to join you, Jeff.
Randall, before we get started, a hot topic right now is the controversy of what went down on the Joe Rogan program about plasma energy. Would you like to make any comment on that before we have you disclose some catastrophism?
Sure. I'll say a few words about that. I've just this new interview that I did with Danny Jones, formerly the Danny Jones podcast, formerly Concrete with a K. I kind of went into pretty much detail on that, and I'm going to be going into that on more. But essentially what went down was this. About 8 years ago, I started having a conversation with an inventor, scientist, a geochemist who was living on an island in the Indian Ocean, who had been through the meat grinder with one of the major oil companies. And he was an oil prospector, which was kind of a natural thing for somebody with a geochemical background. He had discovered an oil reservoir, an oil deposit, and he had obtained the drilling rights from the government of the country that it was in. And there was one of the major oil companies that had overstated their reserves by 30% and had found themselves kind of in a pickle and thought that this oil reservoir was promising enough that if they could obtain the license to drill, it might solve their problem. And so they went on a campaign to discredit Malcolm the inventor and paint him as a nut job to try to scare away investors. So they bribed politicians, they bribed journalists and so forth to create this smear campaign against him. So what happened to him was kind of a precursor to what's happened to a lot of people in the last year or two. If you look at what's going on with Russell Brand right now, you know, here you've got accusations by anonymous sources with no evidence other than hearsay, yet he's being branded as if he's already guilty. Look what happened to Graham Hancock in the aftermath of Ancient Apocalypse. And I spent some time, Jeff, going through the attacks on him. And what the thing that became abundantly clear to me was the fact that they're all reading from the same script. Because, you know, if you took what they were saying at face value, you come away, well, Graham Hancock is a conspiracy nut, he's a white supremacist, he's a racist, never mind that he's married to a woman of color and his children are of mixed race, he's still a racist, right? But if you took that at face value, yeah, now you're going to believe that that's what he is. And then look what, you know, wherever you come down as far as what Robert F. Kennedy Jr., I think he makes very valid points about the vaccines, the efficacy of those and everything. But yet, the way he's being smeared in the media, and what happened to Joe Rogan himself in the aftermath of him having some alternate points of view on there about the pandemic and all of that, you know, with, you know, people like Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and stuff. Oh, we're not going to, you know, we're going to pull our music from Spotify if they have Joe Rogan on there. But so the surprising thing to me is that with all of this that we've seen going on and how media manipulates, that so many people were willing to just buy into this stuff. Well, so Basically, it was last November, almost a year ago. I was on the Joe Rogan show with Graham Hancock, and we were talking ancient civilizations, and the subject of ancient technology came up, which Joe is very interested in. And Graham knew that I had been talking to this inventor that had developed a system of technology based upon plasma energy. Now, at the time, I'm still, you know, I kind of look at myself as far as the technology is concerned and understanding the science behind it. I may be in second grade now. I was still in kindergarten back then. So I'm just learning about it. So I was hesitant to even talk about it because I like to vet things myself. I like to know what I'm talking about. But I went and I made some statements about the inventor, Malcolm, and his situation. And Joe then asked me afterwards if I would come back and talk about that. And I said, sure, to the extent that I'm capable and to the extent that I understand it, I'd be happy to. Well, in the interim, Malcolm came to the United States for a number of reasons, but one of the outcomes of that was I had the opportunity to get coached firsthand in the technology and in the science and how it works. Now, up to this point, I've had several conversations with people that have known him, including Roland Perry, who is probably Australia's top-selling author, who is also an investigative reporter. And he had spent 4 years investigating Malcolm and the technology and in the process became friends with him and concluded that, you know, all of this early stuff was primarily all BS. As a matter of fact, one of the things that came down, they got caught. And in 2003, the entire board of this oil company actually resigned. And it was as a result, at least partially, if not completely, because of this scandal that they got caught in bribing people to try to ultimately gain control of the drilling rights. So what was a little surprising to me, though, is the number of people who just completely bought into it without any critical thought or investigation on their own. And even if any of this was true, and some elements, you know, maybe have been true to some extent, only to the effect that what they do, just like with any of the, you know, whether it's Graham or Russell Brand or Robert F. Kennedy, you look at, yeah, some of the stuff that they're using is based on fact. But what they do, this is how propaganda works. You got to have some element of truth in it in order to give it viability, in order to get people to buy into it and believe it, right? Now, they can totally exaggerate. They can bring in, you know, everything, including the kitchen sink. But as long as there's some element in there, that's how effective propaganda works. Okay, so the result was in February, I went back on Rogan, and Malcolm was here, and George Howard, the founder of the Cosmic Tusk website, who also organized the Cosmic Summit that we had a few months ago, which was an incredible experience, and several other people. We took the drive over to Austin, and I checked with Joe, and I said, look, if you want to talk about the science, I got the guy right here. I mean, I could invite him on because he's going to be able to talk more effectively about the science than I am. And what do you think about that? And he said, sure, bring him on. Okay, so in the interim, Jamie, Joe's producer and tech man there, he goes online to do some background and finds this 15 or 20-year-old stuff and prints out a bunch of it. When we walked in and sat down, Joe was looking at it and basically didn't know what to make of it. The upshot of it was that instead of talking about the science of plasma physics, which is what I totally wanted to do, we got off into all of the scandal, the politics, you know, the conspiracy theories. And during the whole episode, I'm trying to steer it back to let's talk about the science. Let's talk about the science. Anyhow, it got contentious. And Malcolm, he's been up against a lot of obstacles. And so he's, you know, when he gets attacked, he fights back. And which I can't blame him for. Absolutely can't blame him for, you know. Just like I couldn't blame Graham, if he fights back, or Russell Brand, if he fights back against accusations. So anyhow, at the end of it, I'm like, oh God, this did not go down like I was hoping it would. And I'm thinking, okay, so if the upshot of this comes out that this guy is a grifter, that this technology is all fake, well, now my name's going to be tied into that, and my credibility is going to take a hit. And some people have said online, oh, Reynolds lost his credibility, you know. But here's the thing. So then once it was over, Joe comes up, kind of catches me on the side as we're leaving, and he says, would it be okay with you if I didn't air this right away, if I vetted it? And I said, absolutely. It'd be better not to air it, because all it's going to do is just fuel the conspiracy theories, fuel the toxic conversations and arguments back and forth, and be a huge distraction from the science of plasma physics itself. We don't want to go into all of this stuff that happened 15 or 20 years ago in a deliberate effort to undermine this guy's credibility. So fine, don't air it. But I will come back, just me. And in fact, Joe even suggested, would you be willing to come back just you? And I said, yes. My thought, though, is give me some time, because I knew two things. One is that I'm studying pretty deep into trying to understand plasma physics, and I only had a smattering of knowledge before all of this went down. But over the last few years, I began to realize, hey, there is really something here. This is a viable energy solution. I want to know more about it. So I've been studying it, and I thought, okay, the longer interim of time between now, which was last February, and going back on, the more solid is going to be my understanding of the science. Secondly, I also knew that there was some major testing in the pipeline that was going to happen starting particularly in the early summer, and it did. So now there has been a major industrial application that is being tested right now on a substation outside of London, and I've shown some slides and stuff on Danny Jones' podcast. The machine that utilizes the plasma is called a thunderstorm generator, because the principles upon which it works are pretty much precisely the principles by which a thunderstorm is created, by two opposing forces, primarily a temperature differential. And thunderstorms produce lightning, which is plasma, lightning. And there's some very interesting ideas about that there is actually a plasma thread that precedes the exchange of electricity, that the plasma thread connects the cloud layer with the earth, and then the electricity follows the plasma thread between the earth and the cloud layer. Anyways, so the principle of the machine is based upon observations of nature, not unlike how Victor Schauberger came up with technologies based upon his very astute observations of natural processes. So the core of this technology is called the thunderstorm generator. It's based upon, the operation is based on the principle of the Rank Hilch vortex tube, which is used throughout the industry. It's used to cool nuclear reactors. It's used in the air conditioning industry, many other applications. And really, there's no consensus among scientists how the thing actually works. Well, okay, so I knew that coming up that they were already building the components in a machine shop. And there are now videos online. Anybody can go and look at it and see the process as the machinery is being built. You can see the technology being delivered to the site. You can see it being retrofitted. It was a 400 kilowatt Perkins generator at this substation. And of course, the engineers and the managers of this substation are not going to let some whack job come in and retrofit one of their big generators unless they had seen enough to become convinced that there was viability to this technology. So they okayed it. They came in. They brought in Malcolm brought in a group of people. They built this equipment in the shop. There's videos of it online that anybody can go see. They brought it to the site. They retrofitted the generator. They activated it, and it worked exactly as predicted. I would particularly encourage people to watch an interview with one of the scientists there who did the annealing of the components, who says right out, I was totally skeptical, but I've seen it for myself, and I'm not sure. We're going to have a few years ahead of us figuring out how this works, right? So there was that. Then was the Tesla Tech Convention last month in Albuquerque. So Malcolm and George Howard and several other people went there. What they did was they got two generators. I think they were Honda generators. They got the first one. The generator was defective, so they had to go last minute, get another one. They videotaped and live streamed the retrofit of the generator right there on stage. And then they had probably, I wasn't there for this, but they had at least 6 or 8 independent people there, scientists, engineers, technicians, people who had worked with Tesla technology and that kind of thing, independently evaluating the outcome. People who brought their own gas analyzers, one top level scientist who actually works, I don't think I'm supposed to say where he works, but he brought a mass spectrometer. So they had like, 3 or 4 gas analyzers testing the effluents coming out of the exhausts of these generators. They had a mass spectrometer, and they all concurred in the same thing, as that the carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, the nitrous oxide, and other methanes went down and nearly zeroed out, while oxygen went from around 4 or 5% up to 19 to 21%, which is the optimum oxygen concentrations in the atmosphere. Now, all of this has been independently verified by people who came there actually skeptical of what they were going to see. Now, there is, until the report comes out, I can't disclose where or what laboratory it has been in the last month, but I was there, witnessed. I was there with probably 10 or 11 other individuals from industry, from science, people who had backgrounds in engineers, brought their own testing equipment, set up 2 generators, a control generator without the technology, another generator with the technology. And so I was there, was able to see for myself and see what everybody else saw. All of this has been recorded now, by the way. So it's documented. And anybody, the firm that did the testing is writing up a report. And I believe that once that report comes out, it's going to be made public. And at that point, I'll be able to talk freely about the whole thing. But the point is that it was there, the people that were there, highly trained individuals, fully capable of evaluating the efficacy and the validity of this technology. Okay. So I was there in this group, saw it myself, saw what would happen when the generators, when the technology is turned on. You've got the readouts right there. You can watch the analyzers, the gas analyzers. You can, within a minute of turning it on, you begin to see the changes occurring. This has all been well documented, thoroughly documented. And I can say this, one of the people that made a comment about, in the wake of the Danny Jones show, was that this technology or whatever has been well understood. Well, for years, and there's nothing new here, something to that effect. And I would say components, pieces of this, yes, have been understood for years. Going back to Nikola Tesla, coming down through Stanley Myers and Martin Fleischmann and Victor Schauberger, and there's a whole list of inventors and scientists that have explored different aspects of this technology. The difference here is that And Malcolm is the first to admit that he received inspiration and knowledge from all of these predecessors that went before him, right? His different approach, though, was to open source everything. Now, put it out there so that it can never be bottled up or suppressed again. So I was assisted in that process. That was partly what I got recruited for, was to help Jay basically just get the notes, the schematics, the licensing, and the, some of the patent applications out for people to see. And there are now a growing group of independent researchers who are now beginning to test the technology. And it has multiple applications. Like I said, the thing that happened at the substation in London was industrial level. But there is a video online. If you go to HowTube, you'll be able to find all, howtube.com. You'll be able to find all of the links and everything. You can go to a video where Roland Perry, the Australian author, investigative reporter, is there with a couple of mechanics who've just done a retrofit of an internal combustion engine. And they're testing it there in their shop. This was like 2 years ago. It worked, right? Now, here's the thing. It's a new science, but it's a very old science, I believe. I believe it's a recovery of something that people knew once upon a time, a long time ago, that got lost for various reasons, and various elements of that have been rediscovered throughout the last century or more. And now we have a small group of people who are coming around. Like, and here was the thing, one of my takeaways from participating for this weekend at this testing facility in this laboratory was that all of the people involved are looking at it and coming up with a variety of explanations. Okay, we're seeing this. We're seeing the increase in oxygen. We're seeing the decrease in carbon monoxide. We see this extraordinary temperature differential using thermal analyzers in the equipment that makes no sense, but it's here. We're testing it. It's verified over and over again. And what I took away from it is basically we're trying to understand what we're seeing and how this works. And so people who believe that, oh, there, this is, you know, it's something that's been well, you know, that there's nothing new here. No, this is something quantitatively and qualitatively different. And the thing that I have seen over and over now I have personally interacted, if I've not in person or online, had conferences, conversations with probably two dozen highly qualified people now who have, through in one respect or another, have been looking at this. And they're all coming up and discussing and debating what's going on here. What are we seeing? How does this work? So like George Lush in his interview really kind of captures, he says, I was a skeptic, yet I'm sitting here with my thermal analyzer going over and over and over again, not believing what I'm seeing, but I kept doing it until I finally said, okay, this is real. Now the task before us is really figuring out exactly what is going on here, because this plasma physics is a new thing. And people don't want to, they seem to think that well, everything is cut and dried. There's some experts that have already figured this out. And, you know, this is kind of it's the same, similar with climate change. Well, we don't need to look at anything for ourselves because the experts have it all figured out and there's a consensus, blah, blah, blah. Well, BS. You know, we're just at the very beginning of figuring out the climate and weather of this planet and how it works and what are the variables involved. It's the same thing with this plasma physics. But I can tell you this now, there's some major industrial players and governments that are very interested. There was representatives of the Indian government that I met at this testing weekend. As a result of the Tesla Tech conference, a lot of people now are looking at it. There's sort of like a group of backyard inventors that are coming together to say, how can we apply this technology, say on a like garage mechanic level? And you can't. And that's the thing, and that's going to be happening in the next 6 months to a year. And let's see, Alchemical Science, Jordan, I don't remember his last name. We've been communicating with each other. He's in Australia. He's been exploring this and has some really interesting videos up that he's putting up online. I think they're going to be also linked from HowTube. So the bottom line is that yes, this is a new science, but from what I've seen in my study of ancient civilizations and my reading of things like the Vedas and other sources, I had become convinced a long time ago that ancient cultures were much more scientifically and technologically advanced than they've been given credit for. However, how did that knowledge actually manifest? Well, I think we've got a major clue here, and we won't have time to get into this today, Jeff. We can always do a follow-up conversation if you want. And like I say, I may be at the second grade level now. I'm definitely not at a graduate student level with this. However, nobody is really. Even Malcolm the inventor says, there are things here that are mysterious to me, and I don't really fully understand. He'll admit that. He'll admit that. But it works. That's the thing. It works. And this is the thing that frustrated me about what went down with the Rogan podcast, is that so much focus got on the conspiracies and the scandals and this and that. But like my friend Ben Van Kirkwick, who does Uncharted X, made the point, a lot of the people, even Nikola Tesla, if he was alive today, you'd be able to make a very convincing the case that the guy's a nut job, right? He was an eccentric, and he could be acerbic. He could be difficult to deal with. And if somebody wanted to try to discredit Tesla technology, how do you do that? Well, the technology was real. But what you do is you go after the man. You go after the person. And that's what went down here. And the frustrating thing to me is, but I think that this is being overcome now, because enough people are going, wait a second. Whatever the background is to the inventor, and the stuff that's been put out in the media and online is about 98% bullshit. But whatever that is, that's one thing. The question we should be focusing on is the technology real? Does it work? Does it live up to expectations? What is the science behind it? And what frustrated me, Jeff, was how, because of the what went down in the aftermath of the Joe Rogan, was that's all the conversation. Now, all of this time, there are hundreds of pages of notes, you know, that all that stuff was given to me. I passed it over to HowTube. It's been put up online. I think we're coming back to that now. I think the Tesla tech was a big component of that, you know, getting the conversation back. Hopefully the interview I did with Danny Jones is going to help get that conversation back. When these reports come out from this most recent testing, I will say, as far as I haven't gotten an update on the London build out, but apparently officials from the London government, or who are in charge of the power distribution for London, are evaluating the effects and the viability of what this generator retrofit before they allow it to be fed into the power grid of London. But from what I've seen, it's likely that, the other thing I'll mention is that it also typically doubles the efficiency of any engine or generator that it's applied to. That's been another outcome of it. So there's a lot to unpack with it, and I'm in the process of doing that. So are a lot of other individuals. We're communicating with each other. We're sharing ideas and thoughts and notes. I'm a student. I say that right out, that you know, I certainly am not a master of plasma physics, but this is the analogy I use. You don't necessarily need to know anything about the details or the processes by which thermal energy in an internal combustion engine is converted to rotary engine. You don't need to know any of that to know that a car works. You can get in this effing car and go drive it. You know that it works without necessarily understanding the technology. This is kind of where we're at with it, in a sense. And a lot of these very intelligent, very educated people, very highly credentialed people that I've met and gotten to know over the last 6 months, say, are all basically, some of them are feeling confident, I think I've got a handle on what's going on here. Others are, you know, so there's a lot of discussion going on, a lot of debate. And out of this, I think we're going to come to some kind of a consensus eventually. However, it's not absolutely necessary to understand every facet of what's going on with this plasma science or plasma physics to see that it works and that you can actually retrofit an automobile with it and increase, double its efficiency of energy use, eliminate the carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and nitrous oxide that's coming out of the exhaust. One of the applications now that is actually being seriously looked at by at least two governments that I know of, India is one of them, is a retrofit of your coal-fired smokestacks, because it can capture the effluents, and instead of putting out pollution, it's basically putting out air. And there's some funny video footage from the Tesla Tech conference where you know they had it, they had the generator running on stage, but the fumes of it were, you know, was stinking up the auditorium near where the people. Now this is all being watched by several hundred people, and it's being live streamed. It's being live streamed out to the world. To anybody can see it, right? So what they ended up having to do was move the generator out onto the loading dock, right? Because of the fumes. Well, then they turned the technology on, and within a couple of minutes, instead of exhaust gas fumes with carbon monoxide and nitrous oxide and methane and carbon dioxide, all of this stuff coming out, it's air with 20% oxygen, which is the optimum level of oxygen in pristine, unpolluted, let's say, mountain air, right? There's a funny video of George getting down, and we're saying, here's, we can actually see George huffing plasmoids because he's right down there smelling with his nose within inches of the exhaust pipe. And yeah, and everybody standing there is seeing this, witnessing it. The mass spectrometer is showing it's putting out 20% oxygen. It's putting out 0% carbon monoxide. So, I mean, this is all being documented independently now by probably a couple of dozen different players. So the only rationale for saying, oh, this is all a big hoax, it's a con job, is intellectual laziness. Somebody just wants to spout off an opinion about something they know nothing about. Meanwhile, there's a group of people who have seen it, know that it works, will admit we don't fully understand what's going on here, but it works. And now we're going to try to understand, because this technology has tremendous potential to change the industrial landscape of the world if it's implemented on a broad scale. And I, again, go to HowTube or Strike Foundation, watch, listen to the 20-minute interview with George Lush. And what's entertaining and interesting about it is George, this is different George than George Howard, but he's almost scratching his head saying, yeah, I'm as skeptical as they come. But I'm seeing this for myself and going, okay, this is counterintuitive. This shouldn't be happening. But I'm seeing it happen. Okay, that could be almost like something, you know, the old saying from Arthur C. Clarke, any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. Mm-hmm. And George kind of made an allusion to that. He says, it's almost like magic, but there is something going on here. And it has to do with the nature of plasmas. And that's going to be the key. And I think two things: understanding this plasma physics could potentially change the industrial, like I said, and change the industrial landscape of the Earth. It could render a lot of the concerns pretty much about human-induced climate change or global warming irrelevant. And the other thing is I think, without having talked about it and necessarily going there, because I don't want it to, the discussion to suddenly shift over into the woo-woo level. But I think there is some pretty considerable and convincing evidence that this technology has been known to human civilizations in the past and has been lost. So that's a little bit, that's pretty much the story. I mean, there's more I could get into, but that is kind of the gist of it. And hopefully, you know, I'm kind of delaying calling up Joe and saying, Joe, get me back on there and let's do the follow-up conversation, only because every week that goes by, I'm learning more. And I'm definitely wanting to delay until the report comes out from this industrial testing that's been going on over the last month, because that's powerful ammunition. So I haven't been in any hurry to go public with all of this, because I know that this testing has been going on and there are some highly qualified people coming together who are taking a serious look at this. And if this thing was a fraud, it would have been exposed a long time ago. You know, so I'm not in a hurry to get back on Joe. I'm kind of thinking, you know, I'll reach out to him and maybe propose something early next year. But like I said, every week that goes by, there's more evidence coming down proving the veracity of this, and also my own knowledge and understanding of the science is slowly but surely increasing. And so that's why I haven't been on a big hurry to get back on Joe, but I think at some point that needs to happen, because really, Joe, I don't think he knows any of what's evolved over the last 6 months since I was on his show. I think he's still in the paradigm that, oh, this is some con or anything, and he doesn't know anything about the London build out, the Tesla Tech Conference, or the latest industrial testing that's been going on, and the number of highly qualified individuals that have come on board and are looking at this with a skeptical eye, but seeing that there's something very real here. I don't think he knows any of that. Now, with the buzz that I've seen generated around this interview that I did with Danny Jones, it's very possible that some of that is getting back to him. But I really do want Joe to, you know, to be made aware of the fact that, yeah, there's a whole other side to this. It's not just a con job that can be thrown out and dismissed. But there's something potentially very real here. And you, whether you like it or not, I mean, the first major public disclosure of this was on your show. So, hey, you know, might as well take credit when if this thing, you know, goes viral and, you know, it really becomes a viable source of energy that improves everyone's lives. Hey, Joe, you're due some credit, man.
I think we can both agree that in antiquity, they may have used this technology to especially build megastructures like the pyramids. But if they did use it, do you think it was lost to a catastrophic earth change, or perhaps they used the technology for weapons and destroyed themselves?
Okay, really interesting questions, Jeff. Loaded questions. As far as the weaponization, now Malcolm says this, that there's two ways of generating plasmoids, in air and in water. And the plasmoids that are generated in water have a different quality than those generated in air. Don't ask me to explain the difference at this point. Maybe you and I can reconvene in a couple of months to do a follow-up, which I'd be happy to do. Maybe I'll be able to explain it. But he says, yeah, there is potential for that, but not from the water-generated plasmoids. And from what I've seen, it seems to me like the effects of them are really pretty beneficial. And again, I don't really understand that and don't claim to understand that. He has said that it's very possible that you could use it to create weapons, but not with the system that he has developed. That's the bottom line there, not with the system he's developed. But like with anything, you know, you can, I mean, look, electricity has made people's lives immeasurably better. You know, we're sitting here without electricity. What would we be doing? We wouldn't be having this conversation. You know, all of the things that the benefits of electricity, but at the same time, if you misuse it, it can kill you, you know, and they made, you know, electrical chairs. So, which to me isn't such a great use of electricity but that's the point, you know, I mean, anything, there's nothing that's 100% good or 100% evil. That's the whole meaning of that yin yang symbol. You know, if you picture the yin yang, the white figure has the little black dot and the black figure has the little white dot. So yeah, there's always that potential. There's always that potential. But because of the fact that there's a potential downside to electricity, that it could be used in a weapons context, does that mean we abandon electricity and go back to, you know, living a brutal existence, you know, an early 19th century existence when there was no electricity? I don't know of anybody, you know, who would want to be willing to do that. So I think that's how we have to look at it. The question of for a long time, and you probably felt this too or thought this, that, you know, there's so much that we've gotten from the legacy of the past that just doesn't seem to fit the conventional models of prehistory. I mean, are we in kind of, I think we're in agreement on that, right? That there's so much that just doesn't add up within the idea that up until, you know, 5 or 6,000 years ago, from the late going back to the early Paleolithic, it was nothing but hunter gatherers and small tribes, and they never advanced beyond that, which I always found to be, well, kind of incredible. Because consider this, Jeff, how, like, I make this point all the time. You know, when my grandparents were born, it was the 1890s, late 1890s. Well, you had trains, you know, electricity was just in its infancy, you know, but the major mode of transportation was by horseback or on foot or horse-drawn or mule-drawn carriage. I mean, you had trains by then, but you could go back to the grandparents of my grandparents and there were no trains, right? Think about how quickly and how far we've advanced technologically in 4 generations or 5 generations. Now, there are modern human skeletal remains that are now being dated to 180 to even possibly 200,000 years old. Just did a quick calculation. If you figure 25 years to a generation, I'll plug it in right here. I got my calculator right here. Let's say that modern humans go back 200,000 years. If I divide by 25, that's 8,000 generations.
Wow.
Now, within the prevailing models of prehistory, we're supposed to believe that modern humans, with the same cranial capacity and presumably the same intelligence as modern humans, never invented anything, never came up with any scientific understanding of how the world works, of natural law, did not create any kind of a body of knowledge that would be passed on and evolved over generations. When you think about what we've accomplished in 5 generations, how easy would it be for our work of 5 or 6 generations to get lost in the noise of 8,000 generations? So to just dismiss out of hand any possibility of there being more to our ancient past, to me is premature. It's very close-minded. I think we need to be able to reconsider what may or may not have happened in the past. And like you in our pre-show conversation, I think you brought up the pyramid, or maybe, you know, like,
yeah, right,
when we look at, see, the thing is, as a builder, you know, I've been a builder, I'm a 3rd generation builder. So I've had some experience with knowing what it's like to have to move, you know, things that weigh 0.5 ton or 1 ton and what's involved in that, right? When you're talking about all over the world, our ancestors moving with apparent impunity stones that might weigh 10 or 50 or 100 or 200 tons or more. Now, you could think, okay, maybe you're going to have an outlier culture that for whatever reason was obsessed with moving big stones, and they went and put forth all of this tremendous labor and effort to quarry and move 100-ton stones and build these temples. Okay, maybe that would not be too bizarre. But it was all over the world. I mean, there are dozens now of cultures through time and around the world that have apparently been able to cut and quarry and move gigantic stones. That was the thing that led me early on to thinking they had to have had some kind of technological means of doing this that was widespread, that was well known, and we've forgotten it. We've lost it because it just doesn't make sense. You know, we had when I did this, three or four years ago, I was on Rogan with Graham Hancock and Michael Shermer, who's a well-known skeptic.
Yeah.
And I met Michael. He seemed like a great guy, actually. And I am a firm believer that there's an important role for skeptics. There is, because otherwise the woo-woo would just go crazy. And I'm sure in the line of stuff that you're looking in and exploring, you know that it's always important to be somewhat skeptical about the things you hear, right?
Right.
Right. So anyways, the idea is that if you've got an ancient culture, the assumption is that, okay, somehow these hunter-gatherers had enough leisure time that they were able to engage in monumental architecture. And we know that we've seen in the 19th and 20th centuries, hunter-gatherer societies, how many of them engaged in monumental architecture? Name one. Name just one. This doesn't seem to be something that you're going to be doing. You know, you spend a great deal of your time hunting and gathering, and then you've got your leisure time. Okay, it would make sense that you might, you know, create jewelry. We know even Neanderthals were creating art and stuff. Yeah, but quarrying 100-ton stones and moving them over mountains and over vast distances, it just doesn't add up. And the fact that so many of these structures all over the world have this astronomical component, which I know you're well aware of, that so many of these structures have alignments to key astronomical moments and auspicious points in the sky and so on. Again, that's universal. How is it, you know, okay, well, you know, you can use Stonehenge or one of these big structures to know when to plant, mm-hmm. right? And when to reap and when to sow. Well, yeah, but you can do the same thing by putting a stick in the ground. You don't need to build a huge monumental temple with alignments to the equinoctial or solstitial alignments, rising points of the sun. You certainly don't need to monumentalize the 18.6 year lunar cycle. For why in the world would you do that? Well, I think, and I'll tell you this, and I'm thinking, I think I can back this up with some evidence that all of this is part of a technological system. You made the reference to the pyramid. Well, here's something, an interesting fact, that when people go online now and they look at these videos and they see the technology, you'll see that you've got these tubes with spheres, right? And argon gas is used as the medium to move the plasmas through this machinery. There's no moving parts in it. It just like with the Hilch vortex tube, there's no moving parts. It's just the air that's going into a particular geometry. It's going into a motion, a vorticular motion, and it separates the cold and the warm components of room temperature air. And it's a wild thing. Nobody really knows how. There's ideas about what's going, how the thing works, that are still being debated. But the point is, it works to the extent that industry is utilizing the vortex tube. Okay. So it's very similar to that. Now, one of the things is that the pipes, there's a series of concentric pipes and concentric spheres. Okay, the ratios of those components, whether it's the pipes or the spheres, are very precise in order to get to optimize the functioning of the technology. And what's interesting to me is that the numbers that define those ratios are numbers that we find reiteratively occurring in the Vedas, in the Sumerian traditions, in the Bible, etc. And while I knew that for years I've studied these numbers, mostly from the context of architecture, because over and over again, not only are we finding the engineering capabilities of these ancient builders are impressively phenomenal, We also find that there's this astronomical component that's consistent universally all over the world. But there's this other dimension too as well, which is geometry. And that over and over again, we find the same ratios, proportions, and the numbers that are emerging that define those ratios and proportions. 432 is an example of a number that recurs over and over again. 864, 792, these are 108. These are numbers that we find embedded in ancient structures over and over and over again, right? Turns out that these numbers also define the optimum ratios for these, for this system, the ratios of the tubes to the spheres and so on. And if you deviate from that, it loses efficiency. It loses, it's not optimally functioning, right? Now, one of the things is when you make the transition from the tube to the sphere, you have to, you can't just take and punch a round hole in the sphere and put the round tube into it. There has to be a transition in order, because it's all about keeping the motion, the move. See, the process, just like with the vortex tube, is in the motion of the air through the thing. Just like here, it's the motion of the argon carrying the plasma through the machine. Okay, so there has to be a transition between the pipe, the tube, and the sphere. So through experimentation, through empirical testing, an angle was discovered that seems to be the optimum angle to make that transition for guiding that flow from the tube to the sphere. Turns out that angle is 51.84 degrees. Now, is this a coincidence that the slope to base angle of the Great Pyramid of Khufu is 51.84 degrees? And it could that be a little hint that, like you kind of alluded to earlier, that perhaps the pyramid was part of a technological system? And I think we could say perhaps yes. I think we could put that forward as a hypothesis to be tested.
I love that you brought up Stonehenge, because I saw a documentary on it one time about how they move these blocks and they created some kind of railway system. But at the end of the documentary, to me, was the most important thing. And that was they move these blocks 200 miles. And in that time, most people never traveled over 10 or 20 miles in their entire life.
In their entire lives. Yes, Jeff. That's what I'm saying. It's like, once you get into the details, things just aren't adding up. There's a much deeper, more complex history of the human species on planet Earth than conventional models have up to this point recognized or been willing to recognize. And you brought up the question of catastrophism earlier, and clearly that's the thing that I focus on. You said you've got some geological training. I'm a college dropout. But like you, I thought, okay, if I go forward and I get my degree in geology, what's that going to serve me? I can get a job with industry or government primarily. I wasn't interested in that. My interest was in understanding how the world works, how this planet we live on, what its story is, how it works, and so on. And so after, you know, a couple of years, I also realized, you know what? I can learn faster on my own, because there's a lot of extraneous stuff that I would need to study to get a degree. I would rather spend that time out in the field, which I've done thousands of hours in the field, and managed to ally myself with dozens of degreed geologists who have different perspectives and points of view on the geological history of this planet. Now, you can't tell me that going out and spending 3 or 4 days in the field with an expert, let's say, in drumlin topography, is going to be any less valuable than sitting in a room with 50 students watching a professor talk, or watching a video of the professor talking about that subject. Now, I utilize very much, there's so much good stuff online now, you know, where you can go and download and watch stuff on YouTube and other venues for education. But why is, and see, this is where some, you know, and some of the attacks that I've been on the receiving end of, people trying to discredit me say, well, he has no credentials. Like, well, my response to that is, look, there's thousands of people out there with lots of credentials, and I think they're total fools. But that's a different topic. But here's the point. I've only spent 40 years studying geology. Like I said, I have been out, I've spent thousands of hours in the field. I've read thousands of scientific papers. I've collaborated with or studied under or been out in the field with dozens of geologists, right? Now, the attacks that people, oh, well, he has no credentials. Well, so it's like these little arrogant, whatever you want to call them, narcissists or whatever, they're going to throw all of that out. Why? Because they're afraid, I think, of the evidence that I'm bringing to the table and trying to get under discussion. For example, the catastrophic history of this planet and the fact that one of the things that our ancient ancestors were well aware of is that there are times when everything basically goes crazy. And we can see the evidence of that in multiple different ways. I just got back a few days ago from leading a tour up in western Montana, up near not too far from Glacier National Park. And I'm showing the evidence of gigantic terminal ice age mega floods that occurred on such a scale that it's almost impossible to grasp the magnitude of these floods. But, you know, I've spent many, many, many hours traversing many, many, many miles documenting and studying the effects of these catastrophes, the giant catastrophes. So my take now is that, yeah, the ancients in some way were actually had a more realistic model of Earth history than modern academia that's locked into this gradualistic paradigm. They understood that this planet is periodically subjected to tremendous upheavals. And if we're not prepared for that, you know, I mean, I think the legacy of civilization on Earth tends to be, you know, or is that, you know, just like species, we now used to think in the old Darwinian models that species were constantly undergoing this gradualistic transition, so that any given time, let's say 10% of species are going extinct while 10% of species are evolving into the new species. Well, of course, that raises the question of, well, a species is defined, if two species are different, it's because there's no viable reproductive possibility between those two species, right? But the whole Darwinian evolution model is very gradualistic. It's very incremental, right? It raises the question, well, where are all the transitional species rather than we see the endpoints of the continuum, but where's the transitional species? Well, the model that has evolved now, really, and what the evidence is showing is that it's not a gradual transition. There are wholesale episodes of mass species extinctions that have occurred geologically in an eye blink. And then you have a hiatus, and then you have this mysterious, still unexplained process that is referred to as rapid speciation, where after a given amount of time, suddenly there's a whole lot of species proliferating, and the fossils, you know, you have a lot of fossils, then there's an extinction level event. The fossil record is now impoverished of the remains of animals. Permian, Triassic, 90% of all animals, marine and terrestrial, disappeared for a hiatus. This is like same with the Cretaceous Tertiary. The dinosaurs disappeared. You had marine animals that disappeared. You had faunal turnover as well as flora turnover. So there was a tremendous global change in environment and climate and everything that went along with it. Then there's this mysterious period, this hiatus. And then all of a sudden, there's all of these new fossil new species show up in the fossil record. Okay. Now, take that same idea, and I think that just now we know that there are both endogenous, meaning from within the earth and exogenous, meaning from without the earth. And I think that they work together. And what happens is periodically there will be a series of multiple impact events from comet debris or asteroids from space. Oftentimes that will be accompanied with episodic volcanism, which I tend to think is going to be a response. If you take a mile or 2 mile wide asteroid, accelerate it to 20 times the speed of the muzzle velocity of a rifle bullet, and you slam that into the earth, that's going to create a tremendous amount of havoc and destruction and induce climate change. I think one of the consequences of that that we can look at is potentially effects in the geomagnetic field. Effects in seismic and earthquake activity, changes in climate like the onset or termination of an ice age, also episodes of spasmodic volcanism as a response to that. But whatever the exact mix of effects, and these are natural effects, whether cosmic, so what I mean by exogenous outside the earth, or endogenous from within, or that the fact that they work together, what we know is that it's almost certain now that these massive extinction episodes in Earth history are triggered by this kind of phenomenon. Well, now what I'm saying is we need to look at the evolution and history of human civilization on Earth. And what it's appearing is that the same type of phenomena is the case. Just as species have gone extinct in these natural upheavals, civilizations have gone extinct.
About 12,000 years ago was the last ice age, right?
Yes.
Something happened, I think, rather quickly that melted all the ice and caused the flooding. Is that flooding event what the Bible talks about and so many other cultures talk about, the Great Flood?
Well, that is an excellent question, John. My interpretation of it now is that the flooding at the end of the Ice Age was probably not the source of the Noah story. I think that, and this is still awaiting more proof, but there is some evidence that there was a major bolide impact into the Indian Ocean around 6,000 to 7,000 years ago that would have created enormous tsunamis that would have affected all the coastlines on the Indian Ocean. The Arabian Sea is almost like a Venturi flume leading to the Persian Gulf. And any tsunami moving up through the Arabian Sea from the Indian Ocean is going to, as it's making landfall, is going to rise up and become a very huge event, perhaps making landfall at least a minimum of 100, maybe 200, 300, 400 feet in height, in wave height, which would have a tremendous run-in potential. I tend to think that that's the account of the Noah flood. If we go to Plato as a source, and I can never recommend people reading high enough, people reading his two dialogues, Timaeus and Critias, he says right there in the introductory words to talking about the legend of Atlantis, Plato talks about the Egyptian tradition of there being multiple floods and multiple destructions. And I think that the geological evidence bears that out. It looks like the melting of the great ice sheets at the end of the last ice age. From what I'm seeing now, it looks like there were three major pulses of melting. One at 14, and if assuming the dating is has not been biased by circumstances such as a cosmic impact that might, for example, temporarily cause the collapse of the geomagnetic field, which would allow more cosmic rays to come in, galactic cosmic rays, which then create proxies, for example, beryllium 10 and carbon 14, which we can now use as a proxy to understand solar variability. We know that the sun acts as a buffer that prevents cosmic rays from impinging upon the earth that could have deleterious consequences. But aside from that, assuming that the dating is being used, which is radiocarbon dating and primarily optically stimulated luminescence, OSL dating, which I'm not going to get into what that is, other than it's basically, you know, that the fact that there are isotopes created in crystalline structure, primarily quartz and feldspar, that can be affected by the amount of, it's sort of like an atomic clock. And if it's exposed to the sun, it resets the atomic clock. That's the basic idea. But anyhow, it looks like there was a major pulse of global melting at 14,600 years ago. A second pulse coinciding with the Younger Dryas boundary at about 12,900 years ago. And then a third and final major pulse of meltwater injected into the global oceans at 11,600. So you got a 3,000-year span there. The elimination of the ice. Now, you got to bear in mind, we're talking about during the late glacial maximum, when the ice was at its maximum extent around the Earth, it was more than double the amount of ice now. There was two great ice sheets over North America that started independently but grew to the extent where they eventually coalesced. The larger of the two was called the Laurentide Ice Sheet. It was probably a mile and a half thick at its maximum. Its center was over what is now more or less Hudson Bay. And it nucleated around there and then grew out onto the western prairies of Canada. Meanwhile, over the Canadian Rockies from northern United States up to Alaska, you had a secondary ice cap, ice sheet forming. Eventually, it's called the Cordilleran. So the western ice sheet, which at its maximum was roughly the size of the modern-day Greenland ice sheet, and the Laurentide ice sheet, which at its maximum was roughly the size of the Antarctic ice sheet. Then in addition to that, you had a major ice complex over northwestern Europe. The result of all of this accumulated ice was that sea levels were lowered by at least 400 feet. Okay, so now getting rid of that ice and going from a full glacial to an interglacial like we're in now was not accomplished all at once. I think that the evidence shows there were three major transitionary phases, short-lived, catastrophic transitionary phases within that 3,000 years. And the result was that we went from almost full glacial at, say, 15,000 years ago to only residual ice after 11,600. Now, there was a considerable amount of residual ice that would have taken another couple of thousand years to melt away. So this, to me, is kind of compounded the complexity of what happened, is because I think you've got several pulses of extreme melting that occurred, and they're juxtaposed on a series of smaller melting events that are probably more seasonally attributable rather than something greater. I think that the trigger, two potentials for trigger. Candidate number one, impacts probably of the debris of a fragmenting comet, which Earth may have encountered a debris swarm several times during this interval, right? The likely source of that debris stream, the remnants of that, the most likely candidate would be the Taurid meteor stream, which we're just starting, the planet is starting to enter into the outer edges of that. It will peak from about Halloween to the 4th or 5th of November. That will be the peak of the Taurid meteor stream. And I've done a whole presentation of the origins of the universal origins of the Halloween Day of the Dead and its connections with the catastrophes, the great floods, and the Taurid meteor stream. So impacts of things from space, number one. Number two, a much greater variability in the sun could also be playing a role. I think that maybe one of the things that we're seeing might be characterized as a perfect storm, because to get the planet out of the depths of the ice age is a really complex process, which shouldn't have occurred. Because with that much ice, it's dramatically altered the albedo of the Earth, which means the reflectivity. So that if you everybody knows that if you have a white shirt on and you're in the hot sun, the white will reflect heat. You put a black shirt on, and now that's absorbing heat. That's the albedo. You got a lot of area covered in ice or snow. That's reflecting a tremendous amount of heat back into space that's now lost, right? An ice age, it has been said by some glaciologists that an ice age should almost be self-perpetuating. But then it takes some kind of a trigger from outside the system to interrupt that process. And to me, the most likely trigger is going to be something from space, probably an impact. And now there is a tremendous amount of evidence supporting the idea of an impact. There are proxies being found all over the planet, nanodiamonds, microspherals, magnetic grains, iridium, platinum, all of these things that are the signatures of some kind of a cosmic impact. The other thing is, you know, we've been deploying solar observing satellites since the early 90s. We're learning that the sun is far more variable than anybody imagined, you know, pre-satellite observation. The prevailing idea of the sun was the solar constant. In other words, the output of the sun doesn't vary enough to even be concerned about. That was the solar constant idea of the sun was the totally dominant idea when the whole global warming thing started being pushed between 1988 and 1992, right? So if you assume that the variability of the sun is non-existent or so insignificant that you can ignore it, well, then what they did was the sun, the role of the sun, was not incorporated into the computer models. However, we now know that the sun, there's much evidence to suggest that the sun is far more variable than the earlier assumptions. And there's also something else very interesting. There seems to be a connection, and this is not proven yet, but it's a tantalizing connection that would seem to suggest that the infall of cometary masses into the chromosphere seems to have a connection with coronal mass ejections and solar storms. Now, if that proves to be true, this may have really significant implications. If you have, and one of these theories is that around 25 to 30,000 years ago, a very large comet, probably dislodged from the Kuiper disk, made its way towards the sun. And as it passed through the zone of the planets and then into the, as it approached the sun, it did what all comets tend to do towards the ends of their life cycles. It began to disintegrate. Well, if you have a comet nucleus that's 50 to 100 miles in diameter, the debris of that disintegration can be copious. We know from the event of 1908, Tunguska 1908, the Siberian event, you've heard of that, right? The Tunguska.
Right.
Okay, so you know that one small object, 50 meters in diameter, roughly 150 feet, carried the energy of a 15 megaton hydrogen bomb, which could wipe out any urban civilization, any urban center on Earth. I mean, it was over 820 miles of old growth taiga forest that was utterly decimated by this aerial detonation of the Tunguska object. Now, it's important to emphasize aerial detonation because a lot of the models of how vulnerable Earth is to cosmic impacts were based upon crater counting. Well, crater counting is when you have a substantially large object. If it's low density, it might need to be a half a mile in diameter. If it's high density, like an iron asteroid, we can look at the, are you familiar with the famous crater in Arizona near Winslow?
Yeah, I've been there a couple times.
You've been there? Mm-hmm. Oh, good. That's great. That gives you a framework for thinking about it. It's a hell of a big hole, isn't it?
Yes.
Pretty impressive, right?
Yes.
It was produced by an iron asteroid, roughly the same diameter, the same volume as the object that exploded in the air over Siberia in 1908. The difference is the Arizona object was dense, like iron, like almost like cast iron. And it survived its passage through the atmosphere and struck the ground and excavated this tremendous hole. The Tunguska object was low density. It did not survive its passage through the atmosphere. It exploded about 5 miles up. Now, it completely wiped out, like I said, something like 825 square miles of old-growth taiga forest. But what's happening is now, more than a century later, forest has recovered, and another century or two, if you didn't know about this event, it could go completely unknown, right? The Arizona object has left a hole in the ground. It's been there 50,000 years. But here's the thing. If your models of catastrophism acknowledge the role of direct impacts, and your direct impacts is the census of direct impacts is based upon holes in the ground, actual craters, well, you're going to miss the things like Tunguska, which actually the evidence would suggest are far more prevalent than the actual impacts into the ground. And in fact, you might have a swarm of Tunguskas type events that explode in the atmosphere, but would have no trace other than perhaps maybe in an anomalous iridium deposit. There'd be no trace, you know, 10,000 years later that this had happened.
Yeah,
and some of the models,
sense.
And some of the models that have been devised would suggest just that. Also, the thing is that the low density objects are much more copious, much more numerous than the high density objects. In fact, the estimate I've seen is that for every crater that we count in the ground, and that the census worldwide is about roughly 200 craters, and that's really only, you know, gauging from roughly 15% of the surface area. You know, I mean, almost three quarters of the planet is ocean. So if you have an object 50 meters in diameter, like the Arizona object, landing in the ocean, well, you're going to have a tsunami, but you're not going to have a crater to count, see? So I think that we're underestimating the number of cosmic encounters to which this planet has been subjected. And that a lot of these cosmic encounters are lower density objects that don't leave the big craters in the ground. And the census, the counting, the low density objects are much more numerous than the high density objects. So that needs to be factored in. And now there's interesting new work suggesting that Abu Huraira was destroyed 12,900 years ago by a large aerial burst along the lines of the Tunguska event, except even more powerful. And this is the kind of evidence now that we're beginning to see, and we're beginning to see it because we're looking for it, whereas 20 years ago and 30 years ago, we weren't looking for it.
In the beginning, I said that you lead tours, over 50 tours to sites of antiquity. Have you toured Egypt? And if so, what kind of geologic evidence have you seen there that could have taken out the ancient Egyptians?
Okay. The main evidence I've seen there is the wadis that feed into the Nile Valley. And these things are enormous. A lot of them have no water flowing in them now, but they're enormous channels. And how I know that they were mega floods that carved these channels is by looking at the deposits left behind. And so you can look at the wadis and you'll see that there are gigantic boulder accumulations at the mouths of the wadis. Also, papers that I've read suggest that there were like freshwater diatoms and other microscopic creatures that had been found and dated to roughly last ice age that are up to 120 to 150 feet above the modern floodplain of the Nile River. The other thing is that Eastern Mediterranean, and of course I haven't studied this, I haven't looked at this firsthand because, you know, what they have done is taken samples from the basin of the Eastern Mediterranean, sea bottom core samples, dredged them up, looked at them. And what you see is that there are intervals of normal accumulation what you would call like marl, fine-grained sediment, you know, mostly limey type of stuff. And then they are interrupted by these thick layers of what are called sapropel. Sapropel is material that's basically rotten mud, okay? These sapropelitic layers were flushed into the Eastern Mediterranean by gigantic floods coming down the Nile River. And so what they're doing is fresh water is less dense than salt water. Here's what happens. You get the water coming out of the Nile River is fresh, but it's supercharged with sediment, organic material, plants and all kinds of stuff that it's, you know, if you figure that the Nile River is going through these episodes. And in fact, geologists 20 and 30 years ago were looking at this, and they referred to these late ice age wild floods on the Nile River. Wild floods, right, is what they called them.